I am Plato the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Fred Litwin joins me again. He has just published a new book on the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison and the Great Accuser. It is timely, as Sunday is the 57th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, that Mr. Litwin shines a light on the myth of Garrison and debunks the conspiracy theories that the New Orleans district attorney pursued. In the book, Fred looks at Garrison's papers and conducts research throughout the United States and here in Canada to figure out what compelled Garrison and show us how deluded he was. The book is an investigation as well as a dismantling of the rehabilitation of Garrison and the tactics that had a profoundly destructive effect on those Garrison set out to ruin. Fred Litwin is the author of several books, including 2015's Conservative Confidential and his 2018 book, I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak, both of which he previously appeared on the program with. That last book, the result of many years studying the JFK assassination, has led him to believe that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman. Fred Litwin is a marketing professional and an avid volunteer. He is the founder of Northern Blues Music, a label that has released over 70 albums. He also founded the Free Thinking Film Society. Visit onthetrailofdelusion.com for information on how to get the book, which is published by Northern Blues Books. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Fred Litwin. Mr. Litwin, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Nice to talk to you again. We're speaking close to the 57th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. What do you think about every year around November 22nd?
Well, I think it's a time every year to commemorate JFK's life and all the good things and the hope that he brought a lot of people around the world. I mean, I think that was the big part of his presidency until, unfortunately, he was killed, was that he really brought a lot of hope. Whether it was realized is another question. But I also think hard about the fact that there are so many people out there who are trying hard to weave these horrible stories of conspiracy. And in so doing, over the years, have managed to really hurt a lot of people unnecessarily.
And that applies to conspiracies, I guess, you know, with regards to current events and the sword and people in office. Do you think that's increased, say, since the time of the assassination 57 years ago? I mean, it's such a pervasive part of the discourse now that I don't see how you can shake it off.
Well, I think the JFK assassination is sort of the ground zero of conspiracy theories. Everything stems from the JFK assassination, so people can use the assassination to explain foreign policy, international relations, American politics, American history, racism, whatever you want to explain, you can use the JFK assassination. And people like Oliver Stone have used the JFK assassination to explain Vietnam.
Right.
And that's just really not accurate. And so it's unfortunate that this assassination has been abused. And now, I mean, of course, it's worse in the sense that you have all sorts of other conspiracy theories which sort of derive and stem from the assassination that really take you into la-la land.
Are conspiracy theories the preserve, say, of the left more than the right, or what have you found over the last few years, especially in terms of...
The JFK assassination used to be a domain of the left.
Uh-huh.
And until recently, when all of a sudden I think people on the right have decided, hey, this is too much fun, we'd like to be part of it, and you have people like Roger Stone writing a book blaming Lyndon Johnson for the assassination, and you have a variety of other right-wing websites, Lou Rockwell, there's a veterans site, that have really gone down the rabbit hole in JFK assassination, and it's all around the deep state. They've sort of taken that Trumpist view of the deep state and said, hey, we could see the deep state in this conspiracy to kill Kennedy. And so it's sort of the right has sort of caught up to the left on the assassination.
And before we get too far ahead, I want to just, for people listening to us who haven't heard our previous conversation about your last book or even read it, you were quite the conspiracy theorist in years ago with regards to the assassination. You've now become someone who's debunked a lot of those theories. What's changed for you?
Well, once I saw the Zapruder film on national TV in 1975, I was hooked into believing there was a JFK conspiracy, and I've spent years and years researching it. That started to change after I started reading the evidence of the second investigation, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And once I started reading their evidence, and they had done a lot of scientific tests on the assassination, every single one of their tests came out in support of a lone gunman. And that had a very, very big effect on me. And it finally, in the early 90s, I was living in England, and that's when it really hit me, and I decided it was not sustainable to continue to believe in a conspiracy. And I moved over to the other side of the conversation.
As I was reading your book and preparing for a chat, I thought, well, maybe I should watch Oliver Stone's JFK again. But that's a movie that you wouldn't recommend people see, right?
Well, it's a phenomenal movie in the sense that he got great actors and actresses to be in it. It's really, really well done. There's just nothing in it that's accurate. And so I think people should watch it, but I think they should really read a very good book, whether it's mine or Patricia Lambert's book on Oliver Stone and Jim Garrison, to get the real truth. There's nothing in that movie that's true except the date of the assassination.
To Garrison and I guess what motivated him or what shaped him, did his war experience, did that have an influence on his mindset, say?
It very well could have. I mean, Jim Garrison was a war hero in World War II, so he has a very, very good military record, but he started to suffer while he was in the military from psychiatric problems, and in fact had to be released because of those problems. In fact, I posted on my blog his psychiatric records, which indicate that he was severely incapacitated for civilian life.
And so I
don't know what really happened, but clearly he had problems and he saw a psychiatrist.
And do you have a sense of that effect, manifesting itself in later years, say?
Well, I think one way it manifested itself, and again, some of this is speculation, but Garrison, went after homosexuals. He went after gay people in New Orleans, and there is some evidence that, the question is, was he a repressed homosexual himself? And did this all play a part in what his whole investigation was about? It's a lot of still unanswered questions about what really happened.
And what have you concluded, say, in terms of what motivated him in sort of the people that he went after, say?
Well, I think he was certainly motivated by power, and he had been elected to district attorney in 1962, and he went after everybody. He really attacked the judges, he attacked the legislature, he attacked the parole board, he attacked the police, and with really nothing, but he was very, very effective in the public eye and generating headlines in the newspapers, and people started to be scared of Garrison. He also discovered that he had a lot of unused powers in the district attorney's office that he started to use against people. And so he gained in political power. He was motivated by perhaps being governor or being senator. He wanted higher political office. And when this whole idea of reinvestigating the JFK assassination came around, I think he was convinced, number one, that this would make him a national hero if he can solve it. And number two, I think that there was this, something snapped in him, and he went a bit crazy in his investigation.
Were there, say, people who could have, say, checked his power in terms of some of the tactics he employed and some of his pursuits, say?
Well, it was interesting that when his first chief suspect was this man, David Ferry, who was a pilot for Eastern Airlines who had been fired for homosexuality. Garrison went after him, and David Ferry died of natural causes. And after he died, Garrison's staff went to him and said, you know what, you can end all this right now. You could say you were on the right track. Your main suspect died. This will allow you an easy exit from this investigation, and you'll be a hero. And Garrison said, no, are you crazy? We're on the verge of solving the crime of the century. And so he could have been stopped then. But even the governor of Louisiana was scared of Garrison, and he was not going to do anything to get in Garrison's way.
The tactics he employed as DA, a lot of them, unpleasant, a lot of them despicable. You show us just how different our system is in Canada, and I guess one can be pleased that we don't have that sort of system where a DA gets elected.
Yeah.
In this country. What were some of the tactics that he used?
Well, he had the ability as district attorney in New Orleans to subpoena people to the grand jury. So he could just sign a paper, subpoena people to appear before the grand jury, and his favorite tactic was to take their testimony, in secret, of course, and that person was not allowed a lawyer, and he would then charge them with perjury. And once you're charged with perjury, which is a felony, it limits your ability to travel outside of the jurisdiction. You have to get permission. It limits your ability to perhaps get a job, to get a bank loan, a house loan, a mortgage. You have to get a lawyer. It costs you a lot of money. And so people were really scared that they might get caught up with Garrison. And often he would then dismiss the charges right before the trial.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a technique he used a lot.
Yeah.
He also had the ability to indict people by himself. He could just sign a piece of paper and automatically indict anybody on any non-capital charge. And so that gave him a lot of power. He didn't have to go to a grand jury if he didn't want to. Yeah. He didn't have to get anybody's approval to indict people. And so people were scared of his power. You could see it in some of the headlines. At one point, he subpoenaed Marina Oswald, the wife of Lee Harvey Oswald, to come and testify. And there's a big headline in the local paper about how scared she was.
Right. Who was Clay Shaw, and I guess what aroused Garrison's interest in him?
Well, there were, Garrison, there were a couple of leads in New Orleans back in 1963. Lee Harvey Oswald had lived in New Orleans for 5 months prior to the assassination. Right that weekend of the assassination, there was a lawyer in New Orleans, Dean Andrews, and he was in the hospital for double pneumonia. And he was under heavy sedation, and he claimed that weekend on the Saturday that he got a phone call from somebody called Clay Bertrand to ask him to go to Dallas and represent Lee Harvey Oswald. The next day, Oswald was killed, so that was all moot. But then the question was, who was this Clay Bertrand who tried to hire him? Dean Andrews was really sort of unclear as to who it was. It was certainly somebody who was gay. It was somebody who spoke Spanish because he represented a lot of Hispanic kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Garrison had this thought, oh, my God, I'm looking for somebody whose alias is Clay Bertrand. He's gay. He speaks Spanish. Oh, Clay Shaw is gay. Clay Shaw speaks Spanish. And he had this belief that homosexuals, when they use a pseudonym, don't change their first name. So he was convinced that Clay Shaw was the mysterious Clay Bertrand. And he went after Clay Shaw.
And people can read what happens to Shaw as a result of Garrison's going after him. His story, was that something that motivated you to, say, look into Garrison's life and eventually write this book?
Well, I was fascinated by the story of Clay Shaw. It's such a horrific story of how horrible somebody can be treated by the judicial system. And nobody knows the story, and I was really motivated by the fact that Oliver Stone decided to make Garrison the hero and make Clay Shaw the villain in his film JFK. And so Clay Shaw was victimized a second time. And so I told the story in my first book, or my last book. I was a teenage JFK conspiracy freak.
Uh-huh.
But some of the Garrison supporters criticized me because they claimed that I hadn't seen any of Garrison's files, which was true, in fact. I had not gone through Garrison's files. And so I decided, you know what, I really should do it. And as I went through Garrison's files, and they're all online,
yeah,
for free for anybody, I was struck by how many crazy memos I was finding. I was putting them aside because they were just so crazy. And after I had gotten 30 or 40 really silly memos that he had written, I decided, you know what, there's a book here. And in fact, everything I thought about Garrison is actually worse once you go through his papers.
Yeah. What's fascinating as well as I'm reading your book are all the places that you went to. This is all pre-pandemic, obviously. All the research,
yep,
that you did. What other papers did you say seek or find in the course of your travels?
Well, I wanted to find every single primary Garrison document I could find, and so I went to New Orleans to look at the papers of one of Clay Shaw's attorneys. I went to Waco, Texas, to Baylor University to look at the papers of Gus Russo, who was an amazing researcher who did, he was the researcher for the PBS show on Lee Harvey Oswald back in the early 90s.
Uh-huh.
He had some amazing stuff in his papers. I went to Ottawa, Canada to look at the papers of Louis Bloomfield, who was rumored to be part of the assassination through an association with Clay Shaw in Italy. And that was really fascinating. I went wherever I could to find primary Garrison documents, I went.
Someone that you got to talk with was Harry Connick Sr., and he was the district attorney that succeeded Garrison, is that right?
Yes, so he beat Garrison in the early 70s to become the new district attorney, and I went to see him in New Orleans. He was 93 years old, in terrific shape,
uh-huh,
living on his own, and I went to his house and spent an hour talking to him. And the title of my book, Jim Garrison, The Great Accuser, comes from Harry Connick. That's what he said about Jim Garrison in one of the election campaigns, that he was the great accuser. And he told me, what he told me was basically that, you know, when he took over as district attorney, he said the office was a complete mess. They were so focused on the assassination, they had left everything else behind. And he had to really look at every single case. There were appeals that were not being handled. People were in jail that should have been released. He literally had to go through every single file of the office to straighten things out. It was a real awful mess.
We've talked about Oliver Stone and the movie JFK, and one thing that I was thinking about as I was preparing for a chat is, well, what motivates a guy like Stone to say, rehabilitate someone like Garrison in a film like that?
I think Oliver Stone was really motivated by Vietnam. He served in Vietnam, and he really wanted to tell a story about Vietnam. Well, he's told some stories about,
yeah,
Vietnam. This was yet another story, and this was the story of why the United States got into Vietnam. And so, unfortunately, he decided his vehicle to use to explain why he thought American foreign policy changed was Jim Garrison. And he had read Jim Garrison's book On the Trail of the Assassins, and he believed that it was a great story. He licensed the book, and unfortunately, this was the vehicle he felt to use to explain why the U.S. was in Vietnam. I feel sorry for Oliver Stone in that once his movie was made, he spent the next 2 years really on the road explaining all the minutiae of the assassination that he got wrong. Rather than talking about Vietnam, he was talking about magic bullets and the headshot and Garrison and Shaw, and I think he was very frustrated by that.
And unfortunately, with his profile, That shapes how people view Garrison.
to a very, very large degree, because people really aren't aware of what of what really happened. I'll tell you a funny story. I mean, when Oliver Stone was filming the motorcade, they had somebody with a rifle on the grassy knoll in Dallas firing, you know, blanks at the motorcade. And, of course, there was supposed to be smoke from those guns, and there was no smoke. And he actually had to go and hire a smoke machine to make smoke to be seen from the grassy knoll in his film.
The role of Russian misinformation, I mean, was that something that was seen early on after the assassination, say?
There's been several examples of the Soviets using disinformation to try to encourage the belief that the CIA was behind the assassination. I detailed one of those in my last book. In this book, it was back in 67, 3 days after Shaw was arrested. There was a six-part series in a communist newspaper in Rome alleging that Clay Shaw was part of a CIA front operation in Rome called the World Trade Center, and that it was a front for right-wing funding right-wing extremism in Italy. Now, Shaw was on the board of this organization, and this is where Louis Bloomfield comes in, because he was a lawyer in Montreal who worked for some of the shareholders in this organization. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see his files to see, and he wrote hundreds of letters to people involved in this organization, and of course, it was completely false. It really was an attempt at a World Trade Center. It failed in 1962, and there was just no truth to those rumors that this was a CIA front.
One of the things that one gets a sense of as they're reading your book, Fred, is the mindset of conspiracy theorists. And as I was telling you before we started, when you get into the weeds, if you will, It's frightening, and it makes sort of reading the book unenjoyable, in the sense that you're seeing, you know, just how damaged some of these folks are. How have you seen sort of the evolution of the conspiracy theorists over the last 4 years, even? Does that, say, permanently damage the discourse, the political discourse, not only in the United States but elsewhere?
Yeah, there's been a very, very big change, and it used to be back in the 1960s and 70s that when you would discuss the assassination, it was all based on the evidence, typically the 26 volumes of evidence that the Warren Commission released.
Uh-huh.
And so those critics would take that evidence, argue what the evidence meant. They would use that evidence. In the last, more than 4 years, but in the last 20 years, 15 years, you have critics, conspiracy theorists, rejecting all the evidence. So they're not using the 26 volumes. They're saying the Zapruder film was altered. The autopsy x-rays and pictures have been forged. They reject all the evidence so they can weave a much greater conspiracy. It's actually quite frightening, because it's postmodernism gone mad, in the sense that they're just denying reality.
And I still go back to this question of what motivates them to do that, especially the people that we read online, or that we, I guess, are forced to encounter online, who hear or read something and just go with it.
Well, I think a lot of people are motivated by, the assassination. As I said, the assassination can be used for a variety of means. So if you really are looking for something to explain why you think American politics is so off kilter, then you could say, well, everything started with the JFK assassination, there was a coup, we don't have a real foreign policy, or the military-industrial complex took over, or the CIA is out of control. All this stuff, you could use the JFK assassination to explain why you think all of this stuff is happening. And so it's the ultimate explanation, and it's just, you could see connections where there are none, which is what conspiracy theorists do all the time.
Yeah, yeah. You must get asked all the time, Fred, why you still care. I mean, do you ever tire from thinking about this, say?
Well, I get tired from if you're on Facebook, there's lots of avenues now to argue with conspiracy people. And you could argue for a week about a particular point in the assassination. You could actually win the point after a week. And then 2 days later, somebody will come on and make the exact same point. And so do I go and through this argument again with this one person? And so you can get tired of, like, continually explaining over and over again, you know, why the headshot came from behind, why the autopsy x-rays and photographs show this. I mean, so it does get tiring, but I think progress is being made, because public opinion polls show that since 2000, belief in a JFK conspiracy has fallen quite dramatically.
Yeah. Are there still things for you, though, that are unsettled as to the assassination? I mean, are there still things that you want to know?
I would say there's two things. I mean, first off, there are still files being held in Minsk and in Moscow. The Soviet files relating to the assassination. I would like to see if there were any other KGB operations to help convince Americans that the CIA was behind the assassination. So, and there are files also in Havana and Mexico City related to Lee Harvey Oswald that I would certainly like to see released. The only unanswered question for me, and we'll never know the answer, but did somebody try to encourage Oswald in the days before the assassination to do it? I doubt it, because he was very much a loner, but there is the possibility maybe somebody encouraged him, but told him to do it.
Uh-huh.
That is always a possibility.
By the way, I was just thinking, sometime over the last 4 years, Trump had tweeted about some files that were still classified. I don't know if he eventually had those declassified, but is there anything that you might find interesting that the American government could, say, release still?
Well, after Oliver Stone's film, the U.S. government set up the Assassinations Record Review Board to actually look at and release all JFK records. And they took 4 years, and they basically went to every U.S. government agency to say, you've got to inventory and release your files. Now, there were exceptions, and the exceptions were if there were informants named in those files who were still alive,
uh-huh.
Or some sort of foreign intelligence work that might compromise an American operation. So everything has been released, and in fact, all the assassination records have been released. The only files that have not been released are records where there might be an informant or something very sensitive, and which is typically non-assassination based. So to explain further, the records board took a very, very expansive view of what an assassination record was. So for instance, if you were an FBI agent and you worked on the assassination, they said all of your files, even if they're not assassination based,
uh-huh.
have to be released. And so all the assassination based files have been released. There are still some non-assassination files to be released. And so Donald Trump released a lot of them, but there's still some not released. And I will give a prediction that there is nothing in those files. I think they should be released, but we will find there's nothing left to be found out.
And I guess as time goes on, people dying off in the sword, I mean, the possibility, I mean, it's the gift that it keeps on giving, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, there's been a lot of, I mean, the funny part, and in my last book I covered it, there were a lot of sort of so-called stories that were found in the last few files that were released that were all nothing.
Yeah.
And you know, people always hope that there will be this big file that will explain everything, but it's just not going to happen.
Are you working on another book now?
Yes, I have one more book in me on this. It'll be complete my trilogy. And I'm going to go back to the 1960s, or start with the 60s, and go back to the early critics of the Warren Report, Mark Lane and others, and go up to the present. But I'm going to really title it, We Were Misled. And it's how they misled the American public into believing there was a conspiracy. It'll be a bit of a social history of the assassination conspiracy.
So while it is disappointing sometimes to read what went on, It's nonetheless fascinating, as this book is. Congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today, Fred.
Well, thank you very much, Joseph. Great to be with you.
The website for more is at onthetrailofdelusion.com. The book is called On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, The Great Accuser. It is published by Northern Blues Books. Its author, Fred Litwin, joined me on the line from Ottawa. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.